Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. According to natural resource and fire experts, the number of forest fires and their area of destruction is increasing every year and getting harder to fight and recover from. This year, West Coast states saw the brunt of fire devastation, and a few tribes have been affected. Are you wondering about their recovery? And when fires burn in and near tribal communities, what special considerations have to be made? Join us as we talk about wildfires right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A hearing opened Monday re-examining the convictions of a group of men known as the Fairbanks Four for the 1997 beating death of John Hartman. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Alaska Natives George Fries, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, and American Indian Kevin Pease were convicted of killing John Hartman by two juries in two separate trials, but their case has long been plagued by allegations of subpar forensics, coerced confessions, unreliable witnesses, and even racism. Fairbanks Four supporters rallied outside the courthouse where attorneys led by the Alaska Innocence Project introduced a key witness. William Holmes, a man serving double life sentences for other killings, says a group of his friends, not the Fairbanks Four, beat John Hartman in a random attack. Testifying Monday, Holmes describes himself as the driver who dropped off three friends who ran out of sight after Hartman, then returned a few minutes later in an agitated state.
And I was asking them, what happened? And they just kept saying, little Jay was tripping. He stomped him out. So I looked over at Jason Wallace and I said, man, what happened? And he was just kind of just looking like he didn't even say anything. He was just in the zone, kind of looking forward, didn't respond.
Holmes' former friend, Jason Wallace, who's also serving life for an unrelated murder, told a public defender agency employee about the incident in 2003, claiming he was just the driver, a recently unveiled rendition of the story that will come up later in the month-long hearing. State prosecutor Adrienne Bachman acknowledges new evidence in the case, adding she also plans to bring forward witnesses, including an Alaska Native cab driver who says she saw the Fairbanks Four near where Hartman was found dying in the snow.
And she describes the unusual haircut of Kevin Pease, the face of Marvin Roberts, and the elusive or evasive action of two other boys who she perceives are Native or Asian.
Bachman says the witness, who may appear later in the hearing, describes feeling a catch in her spirit, knowing something was amiss. I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
The U.S. Supreme Court denied an appeal Monday from the Sac and Fox Nation and Sons of Jim Thorpe to relocate the sports star's remains from Pennsylvania to Oklahoma. Jacob McClellan of KGOU has more.
After Jim Thorpe's death in 1953, his widow removed his body during his Sac and Fox burial ceremony in Oklahoma, then reached a deal to bury him in the Pennsylvania town that bears his name. The tribe and Thorpe's surviving sons sued to return his remains through the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, but the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled NAGPRA doesn't apply in what it called a family dispute. Sandra Massey is an historic preservationist with the Sac and Fox Nation. She says the Supreme Court's decision is disappointing.
I really honestly believe if somebody looked at that case, read that case, and understood it, that they would have heard it.
An attorney for the tribe says the Supreme Court's denial will end legal efforts for repatriation of Thorpe's remains through NAGPRA for the time being. The 1990 law requires cultural items such as human remains and sacred objects be returned to descendants and tribes. University of Oklahoma law professor Lindsay Robertson says even though the high court's refusal will close the door on this particular version of the case, he thinks the court of public opinion could still play a role.
I think as more and more people become aware, that's bound to have some sort of an impact on the resolution of the case.
Jim Thorpe won the gold medal in the pentathlon and the decathlon in the 1912 Olympic Games in Stockholm. He later played professional football and baseball and is a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I'm Jacob McClelland in Norman, Oklahoma.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Many people faced an active fire season this summer. One of the bigger wildland fires, the North Star Fire, has been burning in Oregon since August 13th and is still having an effect on the area. And this fire destroyed several structures and homes, including some of the Colville Indian Reservation. It also burned a lot of timber, which is an economic source for the tribe. Northwest Deputy Regional Director of Trust Services for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bodhi Shah, says fires are burning hotter, longer, and faster than they ever have before. And he's with us today to share more about this. So as we learn more about how fire and this fire season has impacted on our tribal nations, today we also want to hear from you. And when forest fires burn on tribal land, just how are tribes affected? What about recovery efforts? And if fires are truly burning faster, longer, and hotter, what's the plan for facing them in the future? And what are tribes doing to make sure they're ready to face wildfires that are coming their way? And what about just plain prevention? Join our conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And joining us today from Portland, Oregon, is Bodhi Shah, and he's the Northwest Deputy Regional Director of Trust Services for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he's a member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. And it's our pleasure to welcome Bodhi back to the hour. Good day to you, Bodhi.
Well, good day to you, Tara, and thanks for the invite.
And Bodhi, thank you for being with us. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who are curious to kind of get an update or know how folks are doing in the area. So let's go ahead and start there. Please do give us an update on the situation with some of the Northwest fires.
Yeah, well, thanks, Tara. And to talk a little bit about what we currently have going on. So for our Northwest region Indian Affairs, we've had five tribes severely impacted by wildfire mid-August to current date standing. So starting with Warm Springs, nearly a 70,000-acre fire, four homes lost. That fire is under control. Rehabilitation and salvage operations currently ongoing, and we'll talk a little bit about that a little later. Moving into Idaho, Nez Perce had a series of five fires impacted various parts of the reservation on trust land. Two homes were lost and rehabilitation is currently happening. That fire is contained. Moving over to the Spokane Reservation, that was a fire that started on the reservation mid-August, moved off reservation, 65,000 acres. 26 homes lost in that fire. That fire is contained. Rehabilitation currently ongoing. Moving to, as you mentioned, Tara, the North Star Fire, which is actually on the Colville Reservation with two separate fires, the Tunk Block and the North Star Fire. Series of homes lost there. Those two fires combined worked to be the largest fire in the state of Washington's history, and combined 350,000 acres of fire. That is nearly contained.
about 99%. So we're almost across the line in terms of containment. Rehabilitation has been going on for a couple weeks now. And then moving to the last fire, Yakima on the Cougar Creek, 50,000-acre fire, predominantly around Mount Adams, adjacent to the Forest Service, Washington Department of Natural Resources land, and fire rehabilitation. So repairing a lot of the fire suppression activities, looking at repairing a lot of the fire scars from heavy equipment, as an example, occurring on all of those fires.
And Bodie, you know, that's a lot of places. You know, when we take a look at Native America and are hearing how people are connecting, you know, to this, when you just take a look back at that list, what first comes to your mind of you know, the immediate help or attention that you think folks should be bringing to the area?
And that's a good point. By far and away, this is, if not the most active fire season in Indian country and in northwestern United States. If it's not, it's awfully close to it, because we're pushing almost 500,000 acres between those five reservations that were impacted by fire. And obviously, and we have three tribes, Colville, Yakima, and Warm Springs, that have their own milling infrastructure, but the amount of volume, and let's talk a little bit about that. When people talk about how many acres burned, 500,000 acres, that's a lot of acres. But we start to talk about, well, how many trees were lost? All told, from the five fires, we're talking 1.75 billion board feet. Well, that's a lot. What does that mean? If you convert that to how many homes that wood may provide, the average American home, 1,800 to 2,000 square feet, that would equate to 88,000 homes that timber that was lost to fire could have built. Now what we're doing and assisting with those tribes is a reasonable look at how much of that volume can actually be harvested. And the tribes have been working very diligently over the last couple weeks. And that number, even though we have 1.75 billion board feet lost, what we safely take an estimate at is probably 500,000,000. So, you know, we're talking just a quarter of that. So now we're talking that, and there's enough wood there for 25,000 homes. If you want to put, well, how many log trucks would that be? You know, we're talking over 100,000 log trucks of wood that we will actually be able to salvage. Hopefully, markets being nice to us, meaning that we have a lot of burnt logs that we're going to be putting on the market, and there's only so much of a milling appetite that will take a lot of that. So we're optimistic. We're working with our non-traditional partners, Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, in securing some of these markets. But Tara, back to your original point, this is a lot of fire. It's a lot of damaged wood, and that, as many on your radio show know, is really the backbone of a number of our timber-dominated tribes in the Northwest. Taking Colville as an example, this is three times the amount that they would normally harvest, and that has a huge economic impact, not only for Colville, Yakima, but Warm Springs and Spokane as well.
Wow, Bodie, those numbers definitely give us a lot to think about. And you've also made space for a lot of people in our listening area, not only just communities who have been affected by some of these fires, but also some of our tribal members who go out and fight some of those fires, or maybe are working on the management side. And today, folks, you know, if there's anything you'd like to weigh in about this season, the firefighting season, and lessons learned, you can also call in. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. And maybe you even saw some of these fires affecting communities, you know, some of the ones that Bodie mentioned. And you'd also like to talk about, you know, how they have affected your community. And maybe even, you know, has it kicked your community into thinking about the future and future fires? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And I'd like to go ahead and bring in another voice. Joining us now from Pablo, Montana, is Dr. Adrian Layton, and he's a professor of natural resources at the Salish Kootenai College. And it's our pleasure to welcome him to the hour. Good day to you, Dr. Layton.
Good day. Thanks. A pleasure to be here. And please call me Adrian.
Sure thing. And Adrian, Bodie just, you know, talked a bit about the numbers and, you know, how this may affect, you know, economy in our some of our native nations. Anything you want to say about feeling the cost of what the fire took this season?
Sure, and I think Bodie, you know, put out the numbers really, really well. And but the thing I'd like to reiterate on that is that $1.75 billion, with $1.25 billion being left on the ground, that's not only a current cost, but if you think that most tribes, they basically manage in a sustainable manner where they're only harvesting the equivalent of that year's growth. Well, that's like that was a big amount of money in a savings account that's gone now. So not only have the tribes lost that timber, but they've lost the growth that would have come from that timber for decades to come. Because by the time rehab comes and those trees are back to a size where they can be managed for timber revenue, I mean, we're probably talking 40, 50 years out at the very minimum. So there's a big cost there going forward, not just the current one. And economics right now, you know, I think Bodie's right to be optimistic, but we're also looking at drops in timber prices as salvage comes online already. And the thing that's unfortunate for tribes right now is that the Canadian softwood agreement is about to lapse, or I think it lapsed this week. So there is no longer a kind of price or tariff regulation on Canadian softwood that will be coming into this country, which the timing's really unfortunate because it's just as the tribes are trying to market a decent value for standing timber.
So are you saying that, you know, there's a possibility of getting even bumped out of the market?
Well, I think they're going to see prices drop even more. I mean, there's a glut of salvage that always tends to lower prices, but they're also going to be competing with what has generally been cheaper Canadian import timber.
And Adrian, you know, do you have any knowledge of, you know, where, you know, we might feel some of the impact across the nation? Bodie was talking about, you know, how many homes that could mean. You know, is there any place across the nation that should be ready for less supply coming from tribes?
I think certainly, you know, a lot of wood goes out into the market nationally and gets distributed. I think there will be, in that sense, I don't know if the, like, you know, the East Coast markets and other places will feel much, but I think local markets will, especially any market. There's more and more green building attempts where they try to get local timber, and I think there's been an increasing awareness of the green value of tribally produced timber. So anyone who's trying to get that sort of wood is going to have a problem. And I think, you know, again, coming back to these three milling facilities, which employs hundreds of tribal members collectively, there's going to be a real local pinch in the economy if the mills are struggling to keep up and if they're competing with, you know, if they're having to deal with low prices in the market.
Sure. And if folks are, you know, concerned about this, you can call in, share your thoughts. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. If there's anything you want to comment on how the economy might be impacted in your tribal nation because of this season's wildfires, call in, share your thoughts. You can even ask questions, too, if you want to know more. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go ahead and take our first call. We have Joanne, who has connected to us on KWSO Radio in Warm Springs. It's our pleasure to have her with us. Joanne, your thoughts.
Yes, we're a tribal member contract logger on the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. And if they're doing assisting to losses, you know, for the tribes, how does that trickle down to assist us as tribal member loggers who have missed work? Our allowable cut is already cut back, you know, so days and time off are, you know,
sure,
a lot of money lost for us.
Sure. Big concern. Bodie, anything for our caller, Joanne?
Well, thanks, Joanne. Good to hear you again. This is something that we're currently attempting to take a harder look at. So let's use Warm Springs as an example. Joanne mentions their allowable cut, you know, 10 years, 15 years ago, we were pushing 120 million board foot of green timber, which means that was active timber sales. Now that's dropping down to nearly 30. And this year, for Warm Springs' case, they have nearly hit that 30 million target. Now this fire has come through, which will add realistically probably 8 million board feet of opportunity. And there are a number of tribal contractors. Well, that wood, in terms of getting it out of the woods to the milling for processing, is going to be pretty quick. So we're taking a look now. Well, can we use Warm Springs as an example with 4 to 5 tribal member logging companies, possibly push them if we can reassess and take a look at logistics? Can we use them at a Colville reservation where all of their tribal contractors are currently maxed, and they're going to be, when you have to move that much wood in a short amount of time? And the reason it is short, and I think a lot of our audience may know or may not know, is that blue stain or insects will start to invade the forest, and once they start to drill and set larvae, that quickly starts to diminish the economic return, because now we have a blue stain or we have bug-infested tree. So we're trying to avoid that, which means we need to be very aggressive when it comes to pulling out this material. So what I'm hoping, and we've talked to some of the tribes about this, can we pull from our other tribal loggers who, as Joanne mentions, may be soon to be running out of work? Can we offer up and look at, well, I'll use a federal term, if we dispatch those and utilize them on, once again, our non-traditional partners, can we move them up to Yakima to help move nearly 500,000 board feet, as well as Colville? So that's something we're taking a look at. That doesn't help the local situation, but it does potentially help with our neighbors helping neighbors around Indian Country to help move a lot of this material.
All right. Thank you for that, Bodie. Joanne, also thank you for your call. Again, you can join us by calling in 1-800-996-2848. I think we're getting a really good view of the economic side of things in terms of this summer's wildfire season. But what about the environment? Have you seen certain impacts in your area? Are you worried about the future? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. 2848. And Bodie, let's hear, you know, some of the environmental side of this. You know, what are we looking at? I know you've said the statement that, you know, fires are burning longer, faster, and hotter. What kind of mark is that leaving on the environment?
Another great point. So once again, with the fire season, and many firefighters listening on the phone know this, and I think a lot of our tribal residents too, fires are starting earlier, going longer, burning more intensely than ever before. So what that happens with the intensity is that we have burning so hot that we have a lot of, I'll use a scientific term, hydrophobic soils, which means it repels water. So what we're trying to do in those high-intensity fire areas, which all five of the aforementioned tribes are dealing with, is how do we, at least when the rains do come, and rains have been starting to come, we want to be able to mitigate that risk a little bit of erosion, highly erosive rains, soil erosion. So we're currently looking at how we can help stabilize that soil first and foremost before those rains come. So we may do aerial applications via helicopter and dropping seed, dropping straw on those highly unstable slopes, as an example. So that's what we currently do immediately. More of the long term, a couple years out, under burned area emergency rehabilitation, is to look at how we can better stabilize that soil over the long term. Fortunately, of those five tribes are all going to experience various amounts of snowpack on their fires, which is going to be of benefit. But we want to do what we can prior to the, once again, the rains and the snow arriving. And then when that snow melts, how do we do the best we can to ensure that we don't have high areas of erosion, and then have that seed start so we can have a little bit of small plants and rooting germination already started to prevent a lot of that flow. So from an environmental standpoint, we want to stabilize those soils. We will immediately be planting trees, small seedlings back in those burned areas that had historically had trees. Some of those areas are rangeland areas, but we'll still drill seed for a lot of the grasses, but then the timber will be planting trees. And that's a very active and aggressive program that is national, and teams are already working on many of those areas on and getting slopes and stabilization.
Thanks there, Bodie. And, you know, sometimes when we hear about, you know, why some of these fires are burning in this way, some people say climate change. Adrian, what would you like to add about climate change, maybe even season shifting, and how it's connecting to the fire season that we witnessed this summer?
Sure. Yeah, and it definitely does seem to be climate change driven. One of the things that the models for the Northwest are showing in terms of climate is perhaps a small amount of increase in overall moisture, which is a little bit surprising. But when you kind of dig down and look at that, what you find out is that there's going to be a high chance of more rain in the spring instead of snow, and we have rain on snow events, which tends to melt the snow and create a kind of a flush through the system earlier, which means that we have less low melting snow that kind of keeps those fuels and keeps the forest floor moist into the summer. So we're looking at, you know, as you said, fire season starting earlier, and because it's been hotter and drier in the later summer, fire season's going longer. There was a, you know, assessment of Indian forestry and forest management that came out in 2013. 21 tribes were interviewed about, forest managers were interviewed about what they had seen in terms of climate change impacts. And with only one exception, they all reported longer, hotter summers and longer fire seasons. But combined with that, there's another interesting thing, because for the last 100 years, we've done such a good job of suppressing fire that not only do we have hotter summers, but we have this double whammy of we have higher fuel loads because of the way we've managed. We have denser forests with higher fuel loads than, say, 100 years ago. And a lot of folks are doing fuel reduction. The tribes are kind of leaders in a lot of ways in trying to restore what we call fire regimes, trying to restore forest structures that maybe saw fire on a 20-year return interval, which would be lower-intensity fires that cleaned out the understory. So one of the things that sort of becomes an adaptation to climate change is trying to restore the forest to a more resilient nature that would have been more common 100 years ago.
All right, thanks for that. And folks, you can also share your thoughts today. Our phone lines are open, and the number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And you can also reach out to us on social media, too. Here's a comment that came to us from Facebook. Stephen said, use wisdom of old. Decide where and how, make barrier breaks, and control fire, especially around homes. What would you like to add? Call us right now. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And maybe you were a part of this year's fire season. Anything to report from the ground? You can also give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. And we want to hear from you, Native America. Share your thoughts with us today. We're ready. As fall gets underway, food banks, wood drives, and diaper depots will help many in need. Are you one of them? Has your life been touched by a charity drive, maybe as a recipient, donor, or organizer? Who would you like to give a little thanks to for their efforts and why? Share them with the Worldwide Talking Circle on the next Native America Calling. Thank you.
Ilisagavik College, based in Barrow, is Alaska's only tribal college offering its students a quality, accredited education in a variety of academic and vocational fields. Learn more at ilisagavik.edu or 1-800-478-7337, extension 1772.
Support by Manilik Association, providing health care, tribal, and social services to residents of rural Northwest Alaska.
Funding for Native America Calling provided by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, supporting Medicaid expansion. It's good for Alaskans and Alaska's economy.
Welcome back. You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. And today we are talking about wildfire in Native America. And the National Interagency Fire Center reports, as of September 29th, more than 9 million acres of land have been burned by wildfires. They also say the last time numbers were this high was back in 2006. And we heard in the first half that wildfires are burning faster, longer, and hotter. And is this statement a wake-up call to implement stronger fire management systems in our communities? And what needs to happen to make sure federal, state, and tribal agencies have what they need to effectively prevent and fight wildfires? And what about when wildfires get close to our tribal communities? What's at stake? And how are decisions being made when it comes to saving forest area? And what about protecting valuable resources or even saving homes and structures? Native America, what have you witnessed? And do you feel that these decisions are being made fairly or just the opposite? You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today is Dr. Adrian Layton. He is a professor of natural resources at Salish Kootenai College in Pablo, Montana. Also with us, we have Bodie Shaw, and he is the Northwest Deputy Regional Director of Trust Services for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And it's our pleasure to welcome both of them back. And it looks like we got callers coming in. Let's make room for them. Let's say hello to John here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, connecting to us today on KUNM. John, thank you for your call. And what would you like to share?
You know, a friend of mine runs up through, my friend Mike, he fixes doors up all through the Northwestern and through. He was noticing how Jicarilla country looked really beautiful, like it had been cleaned, you know, so that a lot of preventative work. And is that something that really helped? You know, you think of vets, Native vets coming back from, you know, is that a job that would be wonderful to have, to be able to get in there and keep forests clean? Does it make a difference?
All right. Great question, John. Thank you for that. And Adrian, any words for John?
Sure. Absolutely. It does make a difference. The ability to kind of reduce fuels and clean out areas, especially in strategic areas around communities or on the border, say, with other land management areas, makes a huge difference. And I think there is a potential. There has been a little bit of training both on the BIA and Forest Service side of trying to get Native crews together to do fuels work. Many tribes do employ people seasonally to do fuels work as the funding is available. And there's a piece of legislation that was passed 10 years ago called the Tribal Forest Protection Act, which allows tribes to identify areas of Forest Service and BLM land on their boundaries that maybe isn't being as actively managed, and to request that they be able to go in there with tribal crews and do some of that fuel reduction work. That law has not been as successful as we'd have hoped. I think there's some fixes potentially in Congress about that. But fuels reduction makes a big difference, and it's a great potential job for a lot of people.
All right, John, thank you for your call and question. And here's a comment that came in from Facebook, similar concern. Gray Eagle said, I know that there are some trees whose seeds in the wild require surviving a forest fire before they will grow. There's another take on, you know, why managing our forests comes into play. If there's more that you would like to add, give us a ring. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800 866-996-2848. Here's another comment that came to us via Facebook. Vernon said, for many tribes, their forest is the last remaining critical habitat for their kind. It has yet to achieve equality with the rest of the landscape. He adds, more often than not, tribal landscapes and values are deemed less of a priority during fire decision making, during this fire decision making process. That's what Vernon has on his mind. What do you have on yours when it comes to fire management in Native America? Give us a call. Our phone lines again are open. The number 1-800-996-2848. And let's talk a bit about how things are managed or how calls are made when it comes to fires. I'd like to go ahead and welcome now another voice to the hour. Joining us from Boise, Idaho is Dalen Romero, and he's the operations director for the Bureau of Indian Affairs branch of Wildland Fire Management. And Dalen is a member of Taos Pueblo. It's our pleasure to welcome him to the hour. Hello, Dalen.
Hello, Tara, and thank you for having me on your show.
And thanks for being with us. Dalen, can you give us some insight into how decisions are made when it comes to fires burning, in, on, and near tribal land?
It is a multifaceted process. It starts at the upper levels, at a national level, and trickles down to a regional level, and then trickles down to the agency and tribal levels. But as the fire season progresses, most of those decisions are made at the local level. And once there becomes a competition for fire resources due to activity in multiple areas, that's when the National Multi-Agency Coordinating Group comes together and starts assisting with some of those decisions. With NMAC, and that's the acronym for National Multi-Agency Coordinating Group, they never allocate directly to allocate resources to fires. They will allocate resources to active areas, and it's up to the local and regional levels to advocate for which fires get the resources. And the single overriding suppression priority is the protection of human life, both that of firefighters and of the public.
And
from there, it does go on down to protecting communities, the infrastructure, improvements, natural and cultural resources.
And Dalen, that kind of goes to our Facebook comment of somebody feeling that, tribes are getting less priority. What is your response when you hear folks feeling that, tribes are being taken care of last?
The process, I think, does need some work, as is evidenced by this last fire season. There were a number of tribal programs that were impacted heavily. And part of the priority process, when you're talking about timber, it goes back to the preservation of the natural and cultural resources. And that's below the protection of life and property and also of residents and infrastructure. So I think we do need to elevate the priority ranking somewhat, in my opinion. I think work needs to be done and laws need to be passed, such as NFIRMA, which places a higher emphasis on tribal timber. Because as Bodhi has mentioned in the past, states and federal forests can recover from the loss of timber on their lands. It is much more difficult for tribal entities to recover from the type of events that occurred in the Northwest this past year.
And any more details why that's so?
I guess I'm not sure what your question is, the economic impact of the tribes or the priorities.
Why you said it takes, and we also heard, it takes longer, but other places that there's, recovery. Why is that so? Is there more of a need coming from tribes to speak up or being at the right panels or, what does it take?
That's part of it. Part of the process is that here at, and I'll start at the top of NISFI, the National Interagency Fire Center, there's six representatives that sit on the same and NAC panel. It's the National Association of State Foresters, which represent the 50 states. It's the Forest Service, which represents Forest Service lands. It's the National Park Service. It's the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it's the Bureau of Land Management and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We all have our independent fire programs, and what we're trying to do at this level is coordinate the standards and the efforts for fire suppression nationally. And as I mentioned earlier, once we get that done, we will allocate resources to geographic areas to help them prioritize their fires in their geographic areas. And quite often we find that we may not be getting all the information to those representatives on the regional boards as is necessary to make good decisions. And that just means we've got to be more proactive. We've got to be louder. We've got to make sure that when we do have these meetings, these get-togethers, and in the Northwest this past year, once they went to preparedness level 5, there were two meetings every day where we were able to, where each entity is able to put forward their thoughts and their concerns about the lands that they represent. And I think in many areas we need to be more proactive and more engaged with these meetings and individuals.
Sure. And today is also, you know, an opportunity too for folks to speak out and share their thoughts. Give us a call. Our phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And gentlemen, you know, we also heard from, you know, the administration, President Obama declaring some areas, disaster areas because of wildfires. How does that trickle to our native communities? Bodhi, anything to add?
Sure. And yes, when the president declared through FEMA the disaster declaration, that set into motion a couple of things. First and primarily, it enhanced. The tribes have had the ability to declare their own emergency and go directly to FEMA when the Stafford Act was amended a couple of years back. But what that did is provide a little bit more leverage and brought attention to it. So the aforementioned tribes are all in current modes of submitting their reports to FEMA. So essentially what they have done is all the tribes are quantifying those impacts from the fires, homes lost, damage to infrastructure, quantifying those costs and going up to FEMA. Now what we have to dissect are fire damage, so damage to roads, fencing, those will be covered by the fire, but the homes, as an example, and infrastructure, that once it meets a threshold, FEMA can provide assistance. So all five tribes, actually six, Kalispell as well, since they had to prepare for a fire that never got on the reservation, but they still expended tribal dollars to prepare for that fire, are all in various stages of a FEMA application process.
And Dalen, anything to add?
No, Bodhi's correct, is that there is that mechanism which allows tribes to go directly to the federal government for assistance. They also have the ability to engage with other folks affected by that incident to go in as a group. So either process works. There are pros and cons to both processes, but it is great that we now have the ability to go direct to the U.S. government as a sovereign nation, talking about trust resources.
And what about considering, you know, relationships with the state? Is there anything to add to this conversation about managing fires in our communities and how the state is involved? Dalen, you got any insight on that?
Well, it becomes difficult because all those land owners that I mentioned earlier, they all have slightly varying priorities in when it comes to managing their lands. So it's very difficult when you come together as a group and try to get everybody on the same page. So it's just a continuing effort that needs to be made with all the partners, the tribes, the states, the other federal entities to come to an agreement on how, what type of plan we need to move forward with. And again, because of the competing interests and concerns, it's not as easy as it sounds.
All right. And Adrian, from your viewpoint, too, when it comes to working with the state, any roadblocks that you've seen or maybe even any celebrations when it comes to working with the state and managing fire? Adrian?
Sure. I think it varies by state to state. I think there's a large variety. I think like here in Montana, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes have managed to establish a very good and sort of proactive relationship with tribes. I think historically, a lot of tribes, that hasn't always happened. I think one of the things in this conversation, both with states and sometimes with decision makers from federal agencies, that does need to happen, and that folks like the BIA and Intertribal Timber Council have done a good job with, is reminding and educating other folks about the unique trust responsibility that the federal government has. And I think there has to be more of a conversation, not only with states, but with everyone, about what does that mean when you're allocating resources during a fire? How does that affect whether it goes to save houses in a non-tribal community or to save trust timber in a tribal community? And I think that conversation kind of has gotten a boost forward this summer, and hopefully it'll continue.
And Adrian, when we do mention, you know, making decisions where people live, a lot of times, you know, that comes up in the conversation when we talk about loss. When it comes to our tribal communities, you know, there is a certain set of land and we can't move away. Any thoughts on how we do need to consider, you know, that into this conversation? Adrian?
Yeah, I know, it's a very good point, and it is, you know, it's true not only at an economic level where in tribal communities there's been some numbers that have shown that every dollar that comes in locally is spent about 8 times before it leaves the reservation, as opposed to other places where maybe it bounces around 1 or 2 times and then goes out to Amazon.com or somewhere. So economically, it's true. But when you think, too, that this is the last small piece of an ancestral homeland, that really has to weigh into decision-making, because it's all that the tribes have left in many cases. And it is, the natural resources are not just a huge economic source of sustainability, but ecologically, too, because if that goes, then what happens next?
Sure. And Dalen, you know, another concern is just, you know, what, you know, some of these areas, forest area, brings to our communities. Anything you want to add about the environment and, you know, just providing more oxygen to all of us?
Well, it is very important to manage our resources. And as was mentioned earlier in the program, is that BIA and the tribes do have a very good and robust fuels management program, which is intended to control the intensities when possible of some of the fires that do occur. Some of them are naturally occurring fires on trust, and some we actually set fires to trust to minimize the fuel loading. So if we can do that in a more controlled manner, we will bypass a number of those events as this past fire season, which go way beyond our capability and our capacity to control. And if we can just do that in a controlled manner, I think it's going to be best for everyone and the environment.
And Dalen, when we do think about fire management, forest management, are there any nations who you feel could serve as a model for, you know, managing things well?
I think all the interagency and even the international communities, I think everyone is struggling with this question. How do we better manage our environment and our forest to keep it sustaining, self-sustaining, and to keep it viable? I don't know that anyone has come up with a good idea on how to do that. I think there's a number of ideas out there, but I don't think there's one idea that really outshines another. I think the path that the U.S. is going down right now and trying to put a lot of effort into fuels work to minimize that impact, both putting fire back into the environment and also through mechanical reduction. That will work, but that's going to be a long-term process. Right now, we have to divide the available funding, and it is a finite amount of funding between fuels work and suppression. So we've got to find that fine line where we can have a good balance between sustaining the environment and actually needing to put out those fires that need to be suppressed.
And when it comes to dollars coming into our tribal communities, you know, is it equal what we see going to, you know, other places or even state levels? Or are we lower on the list?
I don't think we are. We look at the priorities that we have in place and we try to make decisions based upon that. You know, you'll hear a number of arguments saying that houses, they're not as important as trust lands. And again, you'll find people on both sides of that argument. But right now, the existing policy direction is protection of life and life to firefighters and the public, and then residents. So once we get that changed, I think we'll be able to and hopefully we'll get that change, we'll be able to increase the priority or the value of trust land and timber so that we can, that all rise up in the priorities.
All right. Thanks for that, Daylin. And Adrian, when we think about ways to manage fire in Native America, what about just turning to what we know, our cultural knowledge or what we did traditionally? Anything to add?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it is true. I think a lot of tribes are looking back at the past, and there's a lot of traditional ecological knowledge about how fire was used as a management tool, in many cases for thousands of years. And that was to everything to promote the growth of medicinal or important food plants like huckleberry, which I think Bodhi knows quite a bit about, and I think it was his master's topic. And there were dozens and dozens of different reasons to use fire around villages or campsites to clean up areas. To in some cases, there's some evidence that it could change weather patterns, temperature patterns. It was used in riparian areas to affect fish flow, nutrient cycling in streams and impacting fish. So there's a huge history there, and I think a lot of tribes are really looking at how they can get fire back on the land in a way that is consistent with how their ancestors did it. And I think that offers us a lot of opportunities. And it's funny because in a way, going back to those sorts of techniques, sort of looking at a different time, it also helps us as we go forward in this new and uncertain climate change, because it gives us more options with controlling big fires as we try to create these resilient fire-adapted landscapes again.
All right, Bodhi, anything to add?
No, echoing, I think, what both Daylin and Adrian have mentioned, and that is a snapshot in time, and I think we're all cognizant of the fact that, you know, as we look at changing landscapes, changing climates, you know, we have to adapt. We have to be able to modify to certain areas at a certain time. So I think land managers today are coming to grips with how we can look at adaptive management. You know, from the fuel standpoint, we get just a pittance in terms of the return on that investment. I think Indian Affairs and Daylin may be able to add some insight to that. We may, I think, $40 million a year for all of Indian country for fuels management. Suppression costs nationally this year are $2.3 billion to fight these fires. So that needs to be at the maybe a higher level of discussion, that return on investment. We had Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell out at Colville and walking her through a lot of those productive fuels treatment areas that were a success and saved many homes on the Colville. That needs to be a much higher level of discussion to take a closer look at that.
And Adrian, just hearing, you know, some of this, is there ever a time where there is pushback where folks are wanting their tribe to access more traditional knowledge? You know, does it become culture versus economic development? Is any of that going on from what you're witnessing when it comes to managing fire in Native America?
I haven't heard much about pushback. I think for the most part, you know, a lot of tribal forest and fire managers are trying to look at what they can learn from their elders and see how they can incorporate that into management. And as Bodhi and Daylin have both expressed, it's becoming sometimes logistically increasingly difficult to to have the funding and to make these sorts of changes. But I think everyone, from what I understand, is there's not really that much of an economic trade-off, I think. I think a little bit more burning and some of the harvesting that has to go to get those stands of trees into condition where you can put fire underneath them doesn't really affect the sort of overall management goals of the tribe.
All right. And Daylan, I want to turn to you. We have a minute for wrap up. Anything you want to leave us with today?
I guess the last thing, and it kind of refers back to the last question that I had, is whether I felt that trust resources were being adequately provided to compared to other landowners. And I've got some numbers here which may help that. But at the peak period in the West this past year, there were just over 32,000 firefighters that were assigned to fires. At the peak period in the Northwest, there were 12,500 firefighters that were assigned to numerous fires. And at one point on trust fires, we had 5,600 firefighters assigned to trust. So that's almost half of the firefighters that were in the Northwest. And I do understand that at times we say, well, why can't we build our trust and our bureau programs, fire programs, to a point where we can handle our need? But when you look at what we currently have, we have roughly 1,200 firefighters that we can put in the field from the BIA and tribal programs. So we had almost four times, almost five times that many firefighters that were assisting us on our trust fires. So I think that in itself shows the support that we are getting from our interagency community when it comes to fires on trust.
All right. Well, that sound means it's time to wrap up the hour. Gentlemen, we do appreciate your call or being on the line with us. And also thanks to our callers, too. Thanks to our guests, Bodhi Shah, Dr. Adrian Layton, and Daylan Romero. You can continue the conversation. If there's more you'd like to say, send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And thanks to our crew this week. We welcome executive producer Art Hughes. Our senior producer is Monica Brain. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. And Stephen Emmons is our engineer. Blake Driver screened your calls today. And also thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, and I'm inviting you back again tomorrow as we take a look at charity drives in Native America. If you have a connection to an upcoming drive, send us a tweet. We'll be back tomorrow.
Support for this program provided by the Anchorage Marriott Downtown, one block from the Denina Convention Center and close to restaurants and shopping, welcoming the upcoming Bureau of Indian Affairs meeting. For booking, 1-800-228-9220 and mention BIA.
Support provided by Shoshone Bannock Tribal Farms, proud producer of free-range, sustainable buffalo jerky. Holiday delivery of original, peppered, and teriyaki buffalo jerky available on orders placed by December 15th. More information at sbtribalfarms.com.
The University of Tulsa College of Law, offering a 100% online master's degree program in Indian law. This degree can move your career forward and help you work effectively in Indian country. Deadline for spring application is December 1st. Info at masterinlaw.utulsa.edu/NAC.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.